and for inviting me to give this seminar here. It's a pleasure for me, and there's, I see some familiar faces. Some of you already seen, already heard about this kind of topic, so I'll try to make some variations like to distract you or something, because yeah, otherwise it could be, I guess, boring. But the topic, okay, let me begin basically by telling you a little bit about the kind of things that I do. So I work in, I'm interested about things that have to do with quantum information. I'm also interested about things that have to do with gravity in general, well, the relativity in general. And basically, well, the kind of things that I do is trying to use tools from one field to say things about the other in both directions, right? So this is a little of a list of topics that I've worked in, and today I'm going to tell you about that, right? So maybe can we use relativistic approaches to treat problems that are kind of well-known non-relativistically to try to get advantage in order to generate resources for that are useful for quantum information tasks, right? So I'm going to talk about entanglement production, okay? So, well, the first question one may ask is why bother, right? I mean, obtaining entanglement is relatively easy. You just need a non-trivial Hamiltonian, a bipartite system. Non-trivial meaning that the state of the two systems is not an eigenstate of the interaction Hamiltonian. And any interaction like that will generate entanglement. So generating entanglement, in general, it's an easy task, right? It's not challenging. So what is challenging, though, it's to be able to do it in a way that we can use it for things, right? So in you know, these three adjectives that I provide here, right? We need it to be reliable, we need it to be sustainable, we need it to be simple, right? So we need to really, if we need entanglement, we need to be able to know that it's gonna work when I switch it on. I need to do it in a way that is not just a tiny amount of entanglement, but I can actually produce as much as I need. And the simpler it gets, experimentally speaking, the better, right? So the question we're gonna be addressing today in general terms is, okay, under what conditions, so this is a very general question anyway, under what conditions can we obtain such entanglement sources? Under what conditions can I generate entanglement with this characteristic, right? Well, so what I'm gonna talk about in particular is that a result that we have in which we found that it's possible actually to obtain this kind of source, an entanglement source that it is like that, using actually relativistic tools to be able to obtain it, to compute it in the light-matter interaction. And you know, by relativistic, I mean that we're gonna go, we're gonna treat the problem, not the problem that is, not that the problem is intrinsically relativistic, it's that the treatment is intrinsically relativistic, right? And so we're gonna discuss it in quantum optics, in the light-matter interaction, in settings that you can do in a quantum optics lab. And actually, I'm gonna try to say something about the generalization to systems outside quantum optics. So what's general behind it, behind this method that we, this result that we found, right? Okay, so let me begin talking a little bit about how you can get two systems that start in a separable state, entangled, through the interaction with a medium. Here, the medium is something very simple. Let's say a one-dimensional harmonic oscillator lattice, for example, right? So I have two systems, two quantum systems, A and B, and I have a lattice, one-dimensional lattice, in the ground state of the lattice, right? And these two guys, I want to know how I can couple A to the lattice locally, B to the lattice locally, and the time evolution ends up with A and B being entangled. So what are the possible mechanisms that we can think of in order to get these two guys entangled? So there are two, right? Well, I'm gonna tell you that there are two. So the first one is communication, right? So A couples locally to, let's say, this node of the lattice, B to this one. There's a perturbation in here, maybe you said one case is like you just switch on the interaction, so this guy couples locally to this guy, there's a perturbation here. There's some photons, whatever you wanna call it, quanta of vibration in this case, phonons that propagate from A, from I to J, right? And B is locally coupling to J, right? So that's communication, exchange of information. So there's, you actually can engineer the system such that very easily you end up with A and B entangled because of course they exchanged phonons, right? They communicated. Fine. So this mechanism is actually limited by the speed of sound, right? Of the speed of light if we talk about a quantum field, right? But let's say we're in the lattice here, that's limited by the speed of sound. So there's no way I can get A and B entangled by via this mechanism until I wait enough time for the phonons to travel from A to B, the signal to travel from A to B. Okay, there's another possibility, and that has to do with taking advantage of pre-existing entanglement in the system. So we have here a lattice that I told you is in the ground state, okay? But it so happens, right, that the, Oh, that shouldn't be like that anyway. I don't know what happened there. So it's here there should be, even the equations are wrong. So here there should be a basis, right, of normal modes, and here the number basis for every single oscillator. So in any case, you have a global basis that is the basis that you construct when you diagonalize the interaction Hamiltonian, right? And there's another basis that I can use to express the state of the lattice, which is just the basis made of the individual states of the oscillator, right? Yeah, well, that's not really important. So the thing is that this guy, right, the ON, the N states here are, you know, the basis that is local to the Fock basis, if you want, of every single oscillator. If you want to call it Fock basis, the number basis. And the one without the N's in here is the global basis, the basis of normal mode. So the zero thing here is the ground normal mode of this whole lattice, okay? So what I mean is that if we want to express the vacuum, the ground state of the lattice in terms of the local basis for every single oscillator, the most important part is that, you know, the vacuum is not the product of all the ground state of every single oscillator, okay? So if we actually trace out the whole lattice except for I and J, what we find is that the state of I and J is actually a non-separable state, right? So the ground state of a lattice, right, individually is a state in which, you know, individual modes, individual nodes of the lattice are in an entangled state with other nodes of the lattice, and that entanglement of entanglement, of course, decreases with distance, but there is entanglement in there. So the other mechanism that we can use is swapping ground state entanglement, right? So there is pre-existing entanglement because we prepare a non-local state, the vacuum state for the lattice, right? So if I couple A and B, right, these two guys, maybe because I just coupled them, right, they see noise, right? They measure fluctuations, right? And those fluctuations happen to be correlated, okay? So what A sees and what B sees, it's locally noise in the sense that they can't tell about the presence, A can't tell about the presence of B until a signal is transmitted, but that noise that they see is actually correlated. So what happens is that out of the interaction with individual individual nodes of that lattice, A and B can get entangled, okay? And this kind of a swapping ground state entanglement is, of course, not limited by the speed of light, right? Because there's no transmission of information whatsoever. What we're doing, there's entanglement in the ground state of the lattice. We're swapping it to the systems A and B, okay? All right. So that happens. Yeah, there's something wrong with the, I don't know if it's the video signal, but this is changing a little bit the plots. I guess that makes it original for those of you that have already seen it. But you may lose some detail, though. Anyway, so that should be red balls. In my computer, in my screen, those are red balls, OK? For some reason, somewhere else is not. So in any case, a quantum field is just the continued version of that lattice that I showed you. So these two mechanisms are in place, right? If you have, imagine you have the vacuum state of a quantum field, and you have two atoms coupling, let's say, an electromagnetic field, and you couple two atoms to that vacuum state. There's two ways to get these two atoms entangled, by exchanging photons, or by swapping entanglement that is in there because we prepare a global vacuum, all right? So, okay, so question so far. Okay, good. So there's one question that you can ask, right? So can we really do that, right? I mean, like, okay, yeah, so you're telling me that the vacuum state is an entangled state of space-like separated regions, that's fine, but is it possible to do it in practice? Even theoretically, right? So the entanglement is in there, but that you describe, you need a Hamiltonian in order to do that entanglement swapping. So is that Hamiltonian really physical? The Hamiltonians in nature resemble what you need to do that? And then that was answered 2005, and the answer is yes. In principle, you can extract entanglement from the vacuum state of a field, or from a non-global state of a field in general, with an interaction that resembles the electromagnetic interaction, with something that is realistic, right? So then the question that we wanted to ask, right, so all these things started trying to look for answers to one question, right? That is, okay, so what are the limits to that process? Imagine that I have a finite volume, I have a quantum field in that finite volume, let's say an optical cavity. So can I repeat the process cyclically and then maybe extract, I don't know, how much entanglement can we extract? So it's basically, is the vacuum entanglement something replaceable? Is there an infinite amount of entanglement there for me to extract? So is there something like, you know, optimal way to extract entanglement from there, some efficiency of the process, something like a Carnot-like cycle, all right? So, well, the answer is pretty disappointed, I guess. though expected, right? Which is nope, no, no. You can't do it sustainably. You very, very fast, if you just extract vacuum entanglement, you very, 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 very soon reach a point in which no more entanglement can be extracted, okay? So the entanglement that you can extract from the vacuum, even though the field is an infinite dimensional system and there's an infinite amount of entanglement in theory there for you to extract, if you actually plug atoms, right, to the field, nope, there's no way that you can extract an infinite amount of entanglement from it, right? So basically, the way in which entanglement resources are exhausted is, well, the entropy of the field state and the atom states start increasing, there's heating, mixes start to appear, to a point in which you can actually extract any entanglement. Okay, so that would be the end of it, right? But what happens if we actually allow the two mechanisms to be in place at the same time, okay? And that is that's connected with the relativistic component of it, okay, as we will see. All right, so I told you, yes, it's possible to do it sustainably. But how, right? Well, was using something that we found by, you know, studying those systems in order to find the thermodynamical behavior of it, right? We found that it is possible to reach a fixed point in time evolution, right? If I repeat cyclically this process of getting two atoms entangled using a quantum field, that process happens to have fixed point under some circumstances, right? And then you can ask, okay, so how general are those circumstances? Well, very, very general, actually. It is relatively easy to do it. And then you can ask, okay, then why no one has told me about that before? I mean, many people more intelligent than you have been working on that for many years. So tell me, why don't they claim something like that? Well, I want to think that that's because you need to go beyond the usual approximations in quantum optics. Because, I mean, if you do the usual approximations, you will never be able to acknowledge that, okay, the existence of that point and the regimes in which that point exists, as we will explain. Right, so let me talk a little bit. I'll be very fast, right? I don't want to spend much time talking about that because most of you, I think, already heard me talking about something like that before at some point. In any case, so in a fully relativistic approach, if we actually approach the light matter or the effective light matter interaction, atom electromagnetism interaction, right? There are several approximations that people usually do that work very, very well for most of the experimental settings that you can think of. So these approximations are the relating wave approximation, the single mode approximation, and there's another one that is very commonly used to do calculations, which is the perturbative approximation, right? Not many calculations can be done, not many results can be obtained in field theory in general. If we try to go beyond perturbation theory, right? But I will argue that to obtain the results that I'm going to present to you, all these three approximations have to be relaxed. Okay, this is a non-perturbative result, what I'm going to tell you about. So in any case, take as an example what happens when we relax these two approximations. So something like the dynamical Casimir effect, a very well-known and recently experimentally proven or simulated, depending on who you ask, is the dynamical Casimir effect. Well, for the dynamical Casimir effect to appear in the light-matter interaction, you need to relax these two approximations that are usually used in quantum optics, okay? So let's try to get some insight on, my God, well, that's bad. there's no way. Let me try something. This is, you know, when you try to do these things, well, I don't really know what really happened here, but hopefully it's solved now. Yeah. Okay, so, you know, plugging it in and out, it worked this time, so I'm very happy that it did. Okay, right. So let me just give you a glimpse on the kind of Hamiltonians that you have in the light-matter interaction. So usually you have the P times E, right, kind of interaction, if you remember how atoms couple to the electromagnetic field. So basically this plays the role of P, right, only that it's a two-level system. I'm considering just a two-level atom. And this is the field in a cavity, in a Dirichlet cavity. I have two mirrors, right, hence the boundary conditions, the spatial part of the modes, right? And this is just a mode expansion of the field. Right? So this is the field operator, okay? So basically, that Hamiltonian tells me that the atom sees the field at the point where the atom is, okay? This is just in the interaction picture. So there are two kinds of terms in this interaction, right? The rotating wave terms and the counter-rotating wave terms. That's what people call them. So let's take a look. You know, it's just basically expanding this product in here. So let's see what they do. So this is the same Hamiltonian in the Schrodinger picture, okay? Much easier to see, right? So let's see. We have two families of terms. We have the rotating wave terms that at first order perturbation theory, for example, give rise to processes that are very intuitive because there is a classical analog to that, right? Basically, for example, that I start with one photon and the atom in the ground state, and via these terms, I evolve with some amplitude of probability, right? I evolve to a state that has zero photons and the atoms in the excited state. That has a classical analog. I have an antenna, so the antenna is in the ground state, some radiation comes, the antenna absorbs the radiation and gets excited, okay? Well, that's that. But there's also this other term. This term doesn't have a classical analog, all right? And the counter-rotating wave terms, what they do at first order perturbation theory is with some probability amplitude, they can make a transition, they allow for a transition from, you know, the ground state of the atom, no photons in the cavity, to the atom getting excited and emitting a photon, right? So that's counterintuitive if we look at it with classical eyes, right? And then if you ask, actually, if you go to the lab and ask people, like, oh, how many times have you seen that, right? Like, you have an atom in the ground state, and that atom just gets excited out of emitting a photon. They will tell you, yeah, sometimes. But when I see it, it's usually a problem of experimental error. Really happening, I never saw those. And then they can say, well, why? Why don't you see them in the lab, right? Well, the reason is the terms that are weighing the time evolution, right? So let me just tell you just a little bit, okay? So for the single mode approximation, if you just compute time evolution, right? First order perturbation theory, evolution of your atom, right? You're gonna have integrals like this one, right? So, okay, let's imagine that omega zero here is the energy gap of my atom. And omega j, well, omega n in general, is going to be all the harmonics in my optical cavity, okay? So imagine that there's one of those harmonics that has the same frequency as the gap of my atom, okay? It's enough to think that there's a minimum, but okay, let's think that there's, to simplify things, there's one frequency that coincides with the gap of my atom. What happens then? Well, the rotating wave terms, the ones that allow for emission of a photon by the exciting or absorption of a photon by exciting, are multiplied, the amplitude of those things happening are proportional to these kind of integrals, okay? So you can see, these kind of integrals, if we're talking about the resonant mode, right, if omega zero is equal to omega j, this is just a zero, so it's just an integral that is proportional, gross proportional linear with t, in this case of infinite switching, right? And then, fine, it gives a signal that grows with t, with delta t, with the amount of time that it expends in interaction. Whereas for the non-resonant modes, when omega n is different from omega zero, right, this guy is never zero, so this is an oscillatory function, and the integral of that is also an oscillatory function, which is bounded by this magnitude in here. So what does that tell us? It tells us that we can actually neglect the contribution from these guys in front of the contribution from these guys if delta t is big, okay? Right, how about the rotating wave approximation? Well, it's similar. So for the terms that allow for vacuum excitations, right? You know, an atom gets excited by emitting a photon. Well, they're weighted with this kind of weight here. Right? Omega zero plus omega n. What does that mean? Well, it means that even for the resonant frequency, this guy is never zero. Actually, it's huge as compared to these guys even. So then what do we have? We have that these integrals are always highly oscillatory. So they give rise to something that is highly oscillatory and is bounded by the sum of the two frequencies. What does that mean? Well, it means that if we are neglecting these guys with respect to this guy, we can as well neglect this guy with respect to this guy, okay? So the result is that in the end, we just can consider the interaction with a single mode or with a very few modes and forget about the terms that excite the vacuum, right? That's fine if times are very long. If times are short, that's not fine. You can tell that these guys could be, you know, if delta t is smaller than this guy, there's no way to tell what if any term will dominate at all. Something more interesting, if you want to repeat cyclically a process many, many, many times, what fails actually is perturbation theory altogether. So these approximations actually are ill-defined in a non-perturbative scenario. So you cannot do in something, if you have a system in which non-perturbative effects are relevant, these approximations cannot be done, none of them. Okay. Oh, by the way, yes, there's these two entanglement mechanisms that I told you about in the rotating wave approximation. The first one, the second one, swapping entanglement from the vacuum, doesn't exist. There's no such thing as vacuum fluctuations if we do rotating wave approximation. Cool. So back to what we're talking about, right? So the usual non-relativistic quantum optics fails to analyze the scenario that I'm going to tell you about. So that means that we're not going to be able to use the rotating wave approximation, the single mode approximation, or even perturbation theory. So then the question is, right, so people didn't do those approximations because they found it, I don't know, interesting or fun, right? They didn't really like to do those approximations. They did them because they allowed them to compute things, okay? That's why we do approximations usually. So, okay, if you relax, actually, if you actually lift all the approximations that people usually do, can you still compute something at all? And the answer is yes, using continuous variable methods, right? So let's replace my atom by a harmonic oscillator, right? And let's observe the following, right? Well, quantum mechanics in general, it's something that is computationally difficult, right? Well, let's take one harmonic oscillator. The Hilbert space associated with one harmonic oscillator is infinite dimensional. You have n harmonic oscillators, things are even worse, okay? So that's bad. Oh, a Hilbert space is very, very big. But not the whole Hilbert space is actually needed, maybe. Maybe you're interested in some region of the Hilbert space that is interesting to you for some reason, right? So let me tell you a little bit about Gaussian states. Probably most of you know what a Gaussian state is, but just in case, a Gaussian state is a state whose Wigner function is a Gaussian, okay? So in many sense, they are called classical, although there's a bunch of papers, including a recent PRL, discussing that, nope, there are things that usually you associate, characteristics that you associate with quantum that these guys display. Okay, some of these guys display. But anyway, that's a different topic. So what kind of states are Gaussian? Well, thermal states are Gaussian. Coherent states are Gaussian. Squeeze states are Gaussian. Squeeze thermal states are Gaussian, right? Those are pretty interesting states. And there's a particular case of all those states, right, that belongs actually to all the classes at the same time, which is the vacuum state, right? The vacuum state of a quantum field is, at the same time, either of them, right? All of them at the same time, a limit of all of them. So there's a bunch of states that are interesting and are Gaussian. And what's good, mathematically speaking, about Gaussian states? Well, given that the Wigner function fully characterizes a quantum state, and the Wigner function is a Gaussian, we know that to characterize a Gaussian, we only need two numbers. We need the mean and the standard deviation, the first and second moment, right? So if we restrict ourselves to zero mean Gaussian states, okay, then we just need the collection of second moments in phase space, right, in order to completely describe the state. So we collect the second moments in something, an object called the covariance matrix, right? That's a useful formalism, right? So imagine I have a set of n plus n, because I want to distinguish detectors from fields, right? Imagine I have n plus n harmonic oscillators, right? So what I do is I'm gonna have a matrix that is of dimension 2n plus n times 2n plus n that collects all the first and second moments, all right? And that's enough to describe the whole quantum state of the n plus n harmonic oscillators. So effectively, we came from an infinite dimensional space, the description in Hilbert space, to a finite dimensional description in phase space for these Gaussian states. That would be useless if we wanted to do evolution, and the evolution takes me out of the Gaussian sector of states, right? So if I have a Hamiltonian that I start with a Gaussian state and at a second, I got something like not a Gaussian state. For example, if I had a Hamiltonian that allows a system to unitarily evolve from the vacuum to the one particle excitation, that will break Gaussianity. So it'll be no point in considering Gaussian states at all if my evolution wouldn't preserve Gaussianity, right? So under what circumstances is Gaussianity preserved? Well, there are theorems that guarantee that Gaussianity is preserved if my Hamiltonian is quadratic. It's relatively easy to see, actually, but then anyway, I'm not gonna tell you about it. So if my Hamiltonian is of this form, okay, where this is a vector of quadratures, right? Then it preserves Gaussianity. And it so happens that the light matter interaction Hamiltonian is quadratic. Actually, if you take a look at the standard model, you'd be surprised. It's almost quadratic. It's actually, you can call it quadratic for that matter, okay? So most of the fundamental interactions, including the atom, that is not fundamental anyway, including the light matter interaction, are like that. which is great because those preserve Gaussianity. If you start from the vacuum state or you start from some Gaussian state, whatever, thermal state, something more common than the vacuum, you can describe the whole evolution within phase space, only describing the evolution of the covariance matrix. So yeah, so you see, imagine in the Heisenberg picture, I have my vector of quadratures. That vector of quadratures, of course, evolves to another vector of quadratures at a given time t, like that, the useful way. But you can actually describe it as a translation, as a linear transformation in phase space, actually a symplectic transformation, a transformation that preserves the commutation relationships, okay? So basically, you can very easily compute that the covariance matrix transforms as a function of t. It's just the initial covariance matrix symplectically transformed like that, okay? So I'm not gonna get into more detail here, but what we end up, so the key point in here is that we start from a differential equation in operators that act on infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and we end up with a differential equation on matrices that act on finite dimensional spaces, and also with a lot of symmetry. So this is the optimal way, right, to get take advantage of all the symmetries that my problem has. My problem has a quadratic Hamiltonian, a lot of symmetry in there, and my initial state is Gaussian, a lot of symmetry in there. So this actually says, okay, let's just discard everything that we don't want, and let's just keep what is essential. So we did that in a paper published relatively recently, in which we analyzed how this is with a lot of detail. I don't think I have the reference though, but I should have anyway. So the thing is, not only we analyze how to do that, we actually say how to apply it to relativistic scenarios. And the nice thing about it is that it allows for solving, you know, the time-dependent problems in general, even when you consider all the relativistic terms contributing. So no need to do those approximations, and you can still compute time evolution. It's very, very, very useful for that. The catch is that you still need it to be in a cavity. For a continuum, it's not practical. But for a discrete number of modes in a quantum field, you can do quantum field theory if you start from a Gaussian state with this kind of formalism, okay? So that's what we use, mathematically speaking, in order to treat this problem. Right, so that's basically what I said. So it's great for the light-matter interaction among other systems, right? And it's great to do a non-perturbative analysis. We don't need to do perturbative expansions here. We can solve exactly the equation, no problem. In general, we can do it for any time-dependent problems, right? So it's really, really ideal for relativistic approaches or for non-relativistic approaches in which you want to include the relativistic terms because in the end, they will play a role, even though the system looks not to be relativistic, okay? So yeah, ideal for the cases where we need to relax approximations like this one. Cool, oh, okay. So let's, yes, half an hour of introduction. So now let's get to the results, okay? So let me present you the kind of settings that we're gonna look at. To begin with, let's consider just two atoms in the ground state and the vacuum state in an optical cavity. And I throw those atoms through the cavity, okay? Well, if enough time is allowed, if the flying time is, you know, long enough, the atoms get entangled, right? Actually, if the time is long enough, I mean that both mechanisms are in place, so they get entangled because they swap entanglement from the vacuum and also because they exchange photons, okay? So the whole effect is, again, relativistic. To have that with a vacuum, there's no way that you can do any of the rotating wave approximations or anything like that. But that, of course, happens. But the vacuum is something very, very non-realistic, really. So what happens if we relax a little bit the state that we put in the cavity? What if I consider a thermal state, okay, instead of the vacuum state? Well, bad news. If we consider a thermal state very, very soon, with temperatures that are below the energy that it requires for the detector to, you know, it's not gap protected. What I mean is that there's a temperature associated with the energy of the gap of the atoms, and you don't even need to reach those temperatures. For very small temperatures, the temperature actually destroys the ability of these two atoms getting entangled. It's not that it decreases at the beginning, but at a finite temperature, you get no entanglement whatsoever, okay? So temperature is bad, okay? So then, yeah, it appears that that's sad for us, right? Because if we have something that is a little bit more realistic than the vacuum state, there's no hope to extract entanglement, right? But then there's this question. So what happens if we actually repeat the process many times, right? Trying to analyze what's going on many times, right? So what we're gonna do is we send many pairs of atoms initialized in the ground state, okay? And let's see what happens. So, keep that in mind. We start with the cavity in an arbitrary Gaussian state. That could be a thermal state. That could be something that is thermal of a given temperature, okay? Whatever, the vacuum state, coherent state, whatever I want. So I got these two atoms in the ground state, and then I throw them through the cavity. They're starting a separable state, like I exemplify here. So they cross the cavity, and they get entangled, right? Or not. Well, it depends. If it's a thermal state, maybe they didn't get entangled. But the state of the field is altered as well as the state of the atom. So OK, let's do another step. Now we remove the atoms, and we prepare a new pair of atoms from a fresh, right? And then we run it again through the cavity and evolve. And we repeat the process many times, right? So we iterate several times. And then while we're doing that, right, of course, in every single cycle, the state of the field is changed. The state of the atoms will be different, right? So the nice thing about it is that if we repeat this process, we find that there is a fixed point, all right? There's a very, very, very broad set of parameters for which you have a fixed point. So to see it, it's very easy. So this is the symplectic matrix. This is what drives time evolution, right? And I divide it in two sectors, the detector sector and the field sector, okay? And the correlations between them, right? Correlations, well, what induces correlations between them. So the partial state of the field at a step k plus one, it's actually an affine transformation of the state of the field at a previous step, or a step k. So we can actually write this in vector form because, I mean, people that work in linear systems are more familiar with this kind of formulation just for, you know, to have the ideas more clear. And this is the linear problem. This is a linear evolution problem, okay? So what happens is that if the eigenvalues of this matrix D are within the unit circle, the system, the field itself, evolves to a fixed point, okay? Now, you may ask, well, cool, mathematically speaking, but what does that mean physically speaking? When do the eigenvalues of D are within the unit circle? So the answer is that if the interaction time is long enough, there's always a fixed point. Meaning that if you actually, the flying time of your atoms is long enough such that there's about 5 times the light crossing time between the atoms, then there's always a fixed point, always, always, okay? No matter what the value of the parameters is. Okay, fine, so you're telling me, okay, so that way you can drive the cavity to a fixed point. Good. Why is that good? You have to convince me why this is good. Well, the question will be, okay, can we extract entanglement from that fixed point? So that fixed point is of any use to us? And then, well, imagine that you can. How fast do we go towards the fixed point if we start from a thermal state? Maybe it takes forever to reach the fixed point, and then it's not useful. So let's answer those questions. So first question, yes, entanglement can be extracted. So here I plot it. This is the number of cycles, the number of times that I send pair of atoms through the cavity. This is logarithmic negativity, and we use that one in particular because it's additive over tensor products, and it's good in order to account for the total amount of entanglement, number of Bell pairs that you can extract out of that. And this is for three different states. The vacuum, so you start extracting some entanglement, and then you're driven towards the fixed point. At some point, you reach it, right? And then you have thermal state 0.5 temperature, 1 temperature. Those are natural units. This means that the temperature of the environment is the same temperature. So the energy, the average energy of the environment, right? It's actually the same as the gap of the atom. So it's the peak of the thermal distribution whose temperature is the gap of the atom. So you would expect that this would be nasty for the atom because it's completely thermalizing the atom if you went enough, right? So very fast. So it's the optimal thermalization of the atom. In any case, you see that when we start from a thermal state, you start extracting no entanglement at all. And at some point, you start extracting entanglement, you know, because we know that the fixed point will be entangled, right? We'll allow for entanglement extraction. So how fast do we go towards the fixed point depending on the temperature? Well, you can see here, fixed point is reached about the thousands or tens of thousands of cycles. And then, yes, of course, the time it takes to reach the fixed point depends a little bit on the initial state, but not much. As you can see, the scale is the same. It's a very, very weak dependence. So the fixed point is reached, right, very fast, independently of the initial state of the field. So if we start from the vacuum state or we start from a thermal state, the fixed point is reached fast, okay? That's cool. That's cool. You can actually drive the state of the cavity to a state that allows for entanglement extraction almost independently of what the initial state is. Okay, let's see. So why is this interesting, right? Well, it's interesting because I didn't tell you anything about what the initial state of the field is for the statements that I made. So of course we prove it for Gaussian states, But no matter what Gaussian state, if the state is whatever Gaussian state that you can think of, like a very hot thermal and squeezed state, it will still be driven to the fixed point that allows for the same amount of entanglement extraction that depends on the parameter of the parameters of my setting, like what kind of atoms I'm using, how fast I throw the atoms through the cavity, but still always a fixed point and always allows for entanglement extraction. Nice thing, no fine tuning is required. So the system drives itself, the dynamics drive the system itself to a point that allows for entanglement extraction. Okay, you don't need to do anything to control the system other than sending atoms and atoms and atoms. So one question that you may ask is that, okay, is this trivial in the sense that is this just cooling, right? Because I'm throwing atoms that are cold, right, to a cavity that at the beginning is hot, let's say, right? The atoms are in the ground state, so they're cold atoms, right? So maybe what is happening here is that you're cooling down the cavity, right? But we will see, I mean, no, the cavity is really not being cooled down. Why? Well, there are two competing trends. I mean, very descriptively, what's going on here is the following. So we're getting the atoms and getting into the cavity. That kicks the cavity, right? That's the switching effect. When I put the atom inside the cavity, all the modes of the cavity are populated, are a little bit perturbed, right? And then, yeah, you're adding energy to the field by doing that. So yeah, of course, the atoms are cold, but they don't interact with all the modes of the cavity the same way. The resonant modes, right, are more effectively strongly coupled than the non-resonant modes. So what it means is that if enough time permitted, right, yes, the cold atoms are going to take energy from the field, but it doesn't happen symmetrically for all the modes in the cavity. The resonant modes give energy, dump energy into the field faster than the non-resonant modes. Actually, the energy is trapped in the non-resonant modes, whereas in the resonant modes, they do have enough time for thermalization to dump the energy into the atoms, right? As a result of that, the process is highly non-thermal. So here I have an estimation of thermality. That estimation of thermality is the ratio between the entropy of my state at a given cycle, okay, and the entropy of the thermal state with the same energy as my same expectation of energy as my state rho, which is actually the maximum possible, right? The thermal state is the one that maximizes the entropy at a given energy. So you can see that for the thermal states, it starts being maximum, right? But this ratio, one, which means that there are thermal states, but very, very fast, we depart from thermality. So this time evolution is not a cooling per se. It's not a thermal process, okay? You can't draw it in a thermodynamic diagram because you don't have quasi-equilibrium in that case. You can't define temperature at every single state, okay? So what else? Yeah, so how expensive is this entanglement extraction thing? So we actually call this process entanglement farming in the sense that we are seeding it by sending a lot of atoms in there, and then the fixed point is there and prepare for you to continue extracting entanglement. So that's what we call entanglement farming, right? So yeah, it's not for free, right? You need to expend, of course, you need to spend energy to get the atoms entangled, but not much. And actually, if you see it here, most of the energy that you spent is spent to drive the field to the fixed point. Once the fixed point is reached, sustaining the process, it's very, very cheap. Actually, the cheapest in the whole evolution. Okay, right. Let me tell you something about long-term instabilities, right? So is the fixed point really a fixed point? And the answer is theory tells you that it's not. So how come? Well, as I told you, we're repeating something many times. So there are small non-perturbative, small non-linear effects that are accumulating cycle by cycle, and they build up, and they are the responsible for all this overall effect. But in the end, they're also responsible for something nasty. Let me put it this way. I mentioned that every time that I get the atoms into the cavity, I'm loading up all the modes of the field. I'm populating all the modes of the field, okay? So when as I told you, the modes that are close to resonance, they dump energy into the atoms, so fine, and not much energy is accumulated on those modes. However, the non-resonant modes, for just because of the switching, the kick-in of the atoms, right, energy is being accumulated in those modes, okay? So at some point, when you're around, depending on the parameters again, 10 to the 8 to 10 to the 10 cycles, the population of those non-resonant modes, it's so high that non-perturbative effects, non-linear effects, become to be non-negligible. So those guys, very, very high, right, very, 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 very far away from resonance, start to interact with the atom, and through the atom with the resonant modes and start screwing up the whole thing and destabilize the fixed point. That happens. After many cycles, the fixed point decays. But then again, in this case, if we relax some idealizations, we get a better results. a better result, which is not actually what usually happens in theoretical physics, right? So if you relax, for example, the problem of accumulating population in the higher modes, you see, if you actually make your mirrors not to be perfect to all frequencies, but actually to be more like real mirrors, so any oscillator system, right? Any resonance system, any like mirrors, for example, or mechanical resonators, whatever, the Q factor, right, is of higher modes, the Q factor really decreases very, very fast with frequency. In other words, two mirrors, right? A mirror won't be a mirror for gamma rays. So as we increase the frequency of the field, of the modes, right? The frequency of the radiation, the mirror will become more and more transparent, okay? So all that energy that is being accumulated in the higher modes will leak out much faster than the state that we need to remain to keep coherent, which is the state of the resonant modes. So making the cavity leaky actually help us keep the stability of the fixed point. Additionally, what about not considering a very sudden switching? What if we go more adiabatic? How if we go more adiabatic? How if we actually throw the atoms more slowly? That's even better, because less population, although the amount of entanglement that you extract in the fixed point decreases with that, the amount of population, the energy build in the non-resonant modes decreases as well. So a more adiabatic switching helps as well for that, okay? So in any case, what I mean is, yes, it's true that formally speaking, this is not a fixed point, but in practice, it will be a fixed point, because the things that actually, the mechanisms that actually allow for the destabilization of the fixed point are not in place in real cavities, okay? Right, so one question to throw here. So why is there a fixed point at all, right? So, yeah, mathematically, you showed me that there's a fixed point. Can you relate the existence of a fixed point with something else, something more fundamental? Well, so let's think about what we're doing right now. So we are throwing atoms through a cavity. So those atoms interact with the cavity. You can think of those atoms as particle detectors, field detectors. They do detect the field. So what is a detector anyway? A detector is a quantum system that interacts with a given system in a way that the interaction ends up giving you some correlations of the final state of your detector with the initial state of your probe system, okay? Well, that's what we have here. So we have a non-trivial interaction Hamiltonian, atom field, and that interaction Hamiltonian generates entanglement, right? So there is some correlations being created between the initial state of the field and the atom. Well, no wonder. Particle detectors in practice are just atoms, usually. A photodetector is an atom, and you multiply the signal by using many techniques, right? But it's just atoms, atoms capturing photons, right? Interacting with the field. So the question is the following. So we know about the quantum Zeno effect, right? It's very easy to understand in using projective measurements, right? If only projective measurements were coherent with quantum theory, right? But how about if we assume that my detector is quantum? So I don't do the quantum to classical transition. My detector is quantum. My detector is interacting with whatever I'm probing, right? And it's a unitary evolution. Well, my detector, if it's a good detector, will get entangled with the state of whatever I'm probing. Then when I trace out, right, the detector, I'm going to end up with something mixed that looks like a state that is classical, a state that is an eigenstate of whatever Hamiltonian I'm using to define the state, right? Well, we're having something like that. So what we are doing here is sending atoms consecutively in a cavity. Those atoms are quantum detectors. So they are measuring the state of the field, right? And in a way, we can think of it as something like the quantum Zeno effect. We're preventing the field from going away by carrying out measurements, right? So we are now currently investigating the connection between the quantum Zeno effect with Achim here and a summer student, David Layden, right? I don't know if you know of him. Some of you may know about him because he worked with some people at PI as well.
So you don't have like quantum state projection?
Sorry, say it again?
So you don't have like quantum state projection?
No, this is fully unitary. So the classicality, yeah. So the collapse, if you want, will be an effect, is the coherence instead. So the coherences on the density matrix go to zero because of the partial trace with the other system, okay? So there's a transfer. Very, very roughly, there is a transfer from, let's say this is the individual systems, right? So I have a field, whatever, with whatever state, right? Right, something like that. And I have a detector. Whatever, okay, I don't mind. Yeah, we know that everything sums up. So it starts like that. So my field has some internal coherence, right? It's a quantum state, right? And then my detector as well. But then the interaction makes a transfer between the coherences in here to the coherences in the bigger matrix. so that when I trace out the one of the systems, I end up with something that has less quantum coherence and behaves more like a classical state. That's collapse, as seen from a fully unitary picture, okay? Something that is consistent with quantum mechanics, on the other hand, because projections cannot be associated with Hermitian, with a unitary evolution. So that would be the mechanism, roughly, right? I mean, this is just very roughly. Okay, so two more things before finishing. Am I going? Yeah, good. Can we do that for real? Is it possible to implement these settings experimentally? Well, it so happens that the kind of settings that you need, coherence times, relaxation times, for these kind of settings, based on the scales of energy that I'm using, right, are exactly the same ones that in the famous cavity experiments of Sir Haroche, he uses. He actually uses atoms to do things like entangling two cavities, or two cavities to entangle an atom, right? It's very similar, actually extremely similar. So we hope that's something to investigate yet, though. But at least in principle, that, you know, the technology is in place to have quantum coherence for the times that you need to do those things, all right? A very rough estimation. And even better, superconducting circuits. In superconducting circuits, there's something called the ultra-strong coupling, developed by these two guys actually here. So I don't have the reference for that. Okay, anyway. So these two papers are applications of the ultra-strong switchable coupling, right, to the settings that I'm considering. Quantum fields, atoms interacting with quantum fields, space-like separated, light separated, time-like separated. And the thing is that the ultra-strong switchable coupling is a technique that as of now, it's currently trying to be developed in the IQC. I know that Adrian Lupascu is working also with, and trying to help as well, but mainly the creator of this thing, which is Juanjo García Ripoll, which is basically a setting in which you can connect and disconnect the interaction as much as you want. It's a very clever setting, right? So you have something like a transmission line field, one-dimensional quantum field. Then you have a qubit, which is a superconducting loop in which you can have flux going clockwise or counterclockwise. Then, of course, if you have a magnetic flux crossing this loop, you break the symmetry between clockwise and counterclockwise, and then you create a gap between the two. That's your qubit, that's your two-level atom. And then what they do is, okay, let's introduce another qubit in here, and by controlling the field, so they do something more clever than that, actually, these three loops in here. By controlling the field inside here, the flux, the magnetic flux inside here, I can control the effective transparency coefficient of this guy, this loop in here, transparency coefficient, right? Such that I can connect or disconnect the interaction of this guy with the field. So that's a very, very clever way to be able to control the switching function the way we want, because that is only dependent on a signal that is a magnetic flux. And, you know, in the lab, they actually have these very, very great and very cheap signal generators that can generate very, very fast signals. And the superconductors actually follow those signals. Unless you go faster than the plasma frequency of the superconductor, everything follows. So you can get as fast as 0.1 nanoseconds in a system in which the speed of light is 1/3 of the speed of light, right? So you can tell that you are even beyond the regions that you need for this. So it is possible in principle.
So the relativistic parameter in there is what?
The relativistic parameter?
Yeah.
In the switching?
Yeah.
The derivative of the switching function, that would be. Depending on how fast that is, you will have relativistic effects or not, yes. Like particle creation, appreciable particle creation.
And in the case of Haroche, it would be the speed at which the atom goes.
No, but that's the great thing. It's related to the speed, of course, because that's the switching, yeah. It's the speed at which they enter. The thing is that for these effects to happen, of course we know that the amount of entanglement is bigger, the sharper the switching, for sure, but even for a smooth switching, it's still in place. And for a smooth switching, all the nasty effects are even minimized. So you just need more cycles to get the same amount of entanglement, but still you have a sustainable source.
And the two atoms have to be in the cavity at the same time.
Oh, yes. They have to transverse the cavity at the same time. Of course, if there's a delay, it's not that important. But you need to have, in most of the cases, two atoms inside the cavity at some point, right? So if you have, because of course in an experiment it's difficult to control how many you have. Actually, Haroche had those problems when he wanted only one atom.
Yeah.
So you can have an atom crossing here, and maybe the other one is here. That would be still fine. Only that you have to be more careful with the switching. This switching is different from this one, but the effect is in there. Algebraically, I can prove that there is entanglement extraction as well. And there will be a fixed point of that. It will change the fixed point though, but it will be an entangling fixed point. That's what you can prove. Because that's related to the, as I said, to the eigenvalues of D and different switching functions don't change the eigenvalues being smaller than one. So there is a fixed point. It changes all the parameters of the fixed point, and that has to be tested, of course. But there is a fixed point. You have something like that. Of course, it will be bad if you always have that. In that case, no, that doesn't work. You need at least some time of two atoms interacting with the field. Okay? And when the time that there's only one because the other one actually left may introduce some noise in the process, still a fixed point, still entangling, but that's the thing that modifies the whole set of parameters. Okay? No questions about that? Cool. So this is the final slide, although with a little bit of movement. So then, yeah, the beyond part of the talk, right, that you announced. I was a little bit, worried about you saying I'm beyond because most of the talk is just the quantum optical setting. But then the question is, okay, how general is this result? Okay, so let me put it this way. At least any system that can be described by a set of harmonic oscillators, can be modeled by a set of harmonic oscillators, will present that behavior. So this behavior is not because we're talking about a quantum field, right? It's because we're talking about harmonic oscillators. So yes, sure, we need to relax all the approximations that in quantum fields means going to relativistic regimes. Oh, no. Not neglecting relativistic contributions that even though they're small, they'll build up, right? It's more related to the algebraic structure of the interaction. So the question here is, okay, the field is just a medium that put the atoms to talk. So, the most abstract way to put the result is to say, any system that allows for both entanglement swapping from the medium and communication, both mechanisms are in place, you will get that effect, okay? So then the big question here would be, okay, can we actually transform any many-body quantum system into a renewable source of entanglement by means of this, right? Well, there's something to be studied. But algebraically, at least, we can guarantee that there will be a similar effect if both mechanisms are in place. So what about relaxing the Gaussian assumption? That's complicated, though, because you need to relax all the approximations. And as I said, people did those approximations not because they were happy that day. It's because they couldn't compute. So we can do perturbative approaches to that. And everything, as long as perturbation theory is fulfilled, everything coincides and seems to be also present for other kind of states. But we cannot prove it yet, right? So that's something to be investigated. So in general, what I tried to show you today is that we can build renewable entanglement sources with this. There's another aspect that I didn't tell you about. Is that these things actually can be used, these kind of settings can be used to prepare states. You have control on the fixed point by controlling the parameters of your problem. So imagine that you want to prepare a given state in a cavity, a very particular Gaussian state, right? Something like that. And I want a way in which I don't need to control a lot, not make many measurements. I really want to have it, the simplest possible. One way to do it is, okay, I'll tell you what kind of atoms and for how long you have to fly them through this cavity. And after doing it many times, you can be sure that you have the state that you're looking at because that's the fixed point that that provides. So we compute the fixed point as a function of the original parameters, and that allows us to prepare the state of the cavity to any of those states in that family, all right? So the final thing is like, okay, so our hope is that actually even relaxing Gaussian quantum mechanics, right? Definitely true within Gaussian quantum mechanics if we talk about Gaussian states. But we have renewable entanglement sources, and in particular in the light matter interaction, we have it, and robust state preparation based on the existence of a fixed point. Okay, again, the interesting thing is that we don't need a lot of tuning or tapering or whatever. We don't need anything. The system it's driven itself through the evolution to the fixed point. Okay, so the most general question to study here is under what conditions do these fixed points exist in general in quantum mechanics, right? In which we have repeated interactions of a medium with fresh quantum systems such that the medium is driven to a fixed point that is of interest. Okay, well, that's all. Thank you very much.
Questions for Eduardo? So you said a couple of times that the fact that there's a fixed point doesn't depend on various parameters or things like that, but does what the fixed point is, how does that vary with the parameters?
Well, it does vary, yes. It's always entangling, but the amount of entanglement varies with those parameters and the fixed point varies. But that's what allows you to have some freedom for state preparation too. So it's sensitive, yeah, it is sensitive. It's not like wildly sensitive, but it does change. And it not only changes with with the parameters of your problem, like the initial state of the atoms, the gap of the atoms, the flying time of the atoms. Also varies if, for example, something like what Ray said, like if you actually have some delay in one atom and the other in the cavity, that changes the fixed point as well.
And to extract the entanglement, do you need to know what that state is, or you extract it? I mean,
you don't need to know it. No.
Okay.
Now, what you end up
the
is
the state that you end up with.
Yes, exactly. So you have the two atoms, and out of these two atoms, you can do, you collect the pairs of atoms, and you do entanglement distillation with them. And then you end up with well pairs. There's a question there?
Yes, how robust would your extraction method be under, let's say, some sort of variation between trials, like a delay that varies very slightly between...
Between what, sorry?
Sorry. Suppose there is a slight uncertainty in the delay between the two atoms for the repeated trial.
Like that, yeah.
How would that affect the formation of the fixed point?
It will affect. So, for example, in the end, you will have if you can determine that for certain. On average, it won't change anything, right? On average, I mean, if it's a statistical error, in the end, you're going to have the same amount of entanglement, right? But if you're telling me like, okay, how does that affect the state preparation? Well, it does. You're going to have, as usual with any method, you're going to have a final state within some experimental error that will be given by your ability to be able to set up your setting. Yeah.
That would make it hard in the Haro-Sch
setting. In the Haro-Sch setting, yes. Not in the superconducting circuit setting, though. Yeah.
Other questions? Great. Nothing. Let's thank Eduardo again.
Thank you.